Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to this week's episode of Mill Liberty. I'm your host, Caleb Franz. This is the voice of liberty for a new generation. I am thrilled to have you here this week. We are winding down the year. We are getting ready for a new year, a new era of politics, a whole new year of tweeting from the president. It's going to be a lot of fun. I predict that next year will probably be worse than this year because that tends to be the trend for the past 5 or 6 years. Each year just gets progressively worse. But we're not here to talk about the negative. We are here to talk about the positive. After all, that is part of the purpose of this program, is to focus on where we can achieve actual liberty in obtainable ways. And that is the exact purpose of today's episode in particular. Today I'm bringing on a guest, Matthew Hurt. He is the Director of External Relations at the Grassroots Leadership Academy. Now that's a training branch of Americans for Prosperity. And he is a really sharp guy, a really smart guy, somebody who I am fortunate enough to call a friend. And I think he has the right idea when it comes to training for liberty, when it comes to communicating for liberty. A lot of the reason why I wanted to bring him on is because a lot of what he does is very similar to a lot of what we are going to be doing, or what we are already doing at the Mill Liberty Initiative. And I wanted to make that a little bit more clear and a little bit more obtainable for you. And I wanted him to come on to tell some of his stories, some of his experiences, some of his ideas and persuasions on certain things, and how to best communicate that message of liberty so that everyone can understand it. So, without further ado, please sit back and enjoy my interview with Matthew Hurt on the communication of liberty. All right, Matt, welcome to Mill Liberty. It's good to have you on.
Yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity.
Well, I am thrilled to have you on the program here. I think it's been some time that I've been meaning to get you on. Let's start out by having you tell the audience what it is exactly that you do and how that relates to your place in the Liberty Movement.
I am the Director of External Relationships for the training arm of Americans for Prosperity Foundation, and we're the Grassroots Leadership Academy. And essentially in that capacity, I go out to the states where we have relationships and the states where there are people who we can work with and engage with, not only our activists at Americans for Prosperity and the foundation, but also activists across the political spectrum who are looking to advance what we call free societies, societies where the individuals and the institutions seek to break down barriers that prevent people from achieving their potential, so that we can promote and work in a society of mutual benefit, where, for instance, Caleb, your podcast here is successful because you provide content people want to listen to, or the restaurant down the street provides a good chicken lunch or something like that. So encouraging people to engage in those activities where both parties benefit. And where I fit then in this broader movement is having been involved, you know, even since high school, being engaged in this and in the last 10 years, I've really been involved across the country bringing communities together. And one of the cool things about this movement, and particularly about the last 10 years of small D democratic movements, is the advent of social media. And prior to really Facebook, people in their own communities, maybe it took longer for them to learn how other communities were working on the same issue. And now we can literally go to Facebook, we can go to social media, we can connect with the broader network across the country. And that's what I do, is help connect those individuals so that if someone's doing something better, smarter, faster, and they're more influential, I want to connect them with the folks who are trying to do that.
So you certainly travel a lot, probably more than anyone else I see online, or pretty close to it. Tell me, what are the type of demographics, and I don't mean demographics just in the traditional sense, but obviously the age and diversity and things like that, but also in the sense of ideology and political philosophy. What kind of demographics are attracted to these training courses that are put on by GLA?
One of the really cool things that I've seen in this role, and not only as a trainer for the Grassroots Leadership Academy, but is helping foster these relationships and build coalitions, is I think of a Frederick Douglass quote, which is essentially, "I will work with anyone to do what is good and with no one to do bad or do harm."
Yeah.
And in some of the issues that we're talking about today in the public discourse, we found broad coalitions. For instance, I'm actually calling in from Little Rock, Arkansas, because last night the Americans for Prosperity chapter here hosted a town hall event about criminal justice reform, about the First Step Act. And they had a representative from Cut 50, which is a criminal justice reform advocacy group in D.C. and across the country. They had a representative from law enforcement who came in and talked about the practical, practical application of this. They had someone from the community who has been working in sort of reentry programs for a long time. And then they had a member of Congress, Congressman French Hill, who was a leader on the policy in the House earlier this year. And then in the audience, it was fascinating. It was really cool. You saw traditional, more conservative or Tea Party or Republican types. You saw actually women and others who have reentered society, so people who had had experiences with the criminal justice system who wanted to share their story or wanted to be present. They were there. There were members of the broader criminal justice community who are seeing these efforts play out at the state level. And then the age range really runs the gamut. You know, just a few days ago, at the time of this recording, the weekend before, I was in Las Vegas, where we trained more than 150 activists from all over the West, from Nevada, from Montana, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, Arizona, Utah.
Wow.
And it was a broad spectrum. We had older activists who had been involved for a long time. We had young people who were just getting sort of their feet wet in the political process. Obviously, the racial breakdown was diverse as well. So there's some really great activists in Las Vegas who don't look like the traditional conservative activists, and they're working on these issues because the common thread that runs among and between all of them is they all support the ideas of breaking down barriers that prevent people from achieving their potential and engaging in a society of mutual benefit where everyone helps everyone else, and that is how we become productive and successful.
So one of the things that I really like about what you have been doing and just GLA and AFP in a broader sense is that you really, I think, have fine-tuned the art of bridging the gap between communication and communicating these ideas properly, as well as applying them in a meaningful sense, which that is more or less the core of what I decided to branch out and create with the Maliberty Initiative. So tell me what is, as far as whenever you're looking at applying these ideas to action, what is the best route that you have seen taken when trying to go beyond just sitting around in a room and talking about these ideas?
I think one of the things that we have to be able to communicate is either the human consequences of bad public policy or bad thinking and the benefits of good public policy and good thinking. And so when parents in an urban setting or or even in a rural setting, they're in a failing school system, when they get an opportunity to move their child to the school of their choice, or when a business owner breaks down a barrier from the state or from a local government that prevents him or her from starting that small business, or when a young person wants to launch the next great idea, the next big thing, it's telling those stories. And in a lot of the conversations we're seeing across public policy, across criminal justice reform, tax issues, foreign policy, is humanizing those issues. And for a lot of folks on the right, they communicate with facts, and they expect to lay out the facts for the audience to say, this is correct, and I agree with you, and now what? And so it's very important to come prepared with facts, but it's important to weave the elements of the public policy through a story. You know, as children, our parents tell us, they tell us bedtime stories. At church, we read about the parables. Yeah. And all of these instances in human history where critically important values were communicated through storytelling. And that is such a big part of what the Grassroots Leadership Academy is doing, is empowering people, one, to do the research and to know what is accurate and what is true, so that they can go out and be knowledgeable, but two, how to internalize those facts and tell the story of those facts that do more than just play to what we know, play to our brain. We also have to play to the emotional side. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that, you know, understanding your audience is a tremendous burden, is a hurdle that people have to get over. And so that's something that we're doing every day. You know, just last night or at this event in Little Rock, the representative from Cut 50, from the Criminal Justice Reform Organization, she talked about how she had served 7 years in prison and knew what it was like to be incarcerated and knew the ins and outs of those problems that she faced. And so she was able to tell that to an audience where, you know, not insignificant percentage of the audience had never spent a considerable amount of time in jail. And so, you know, again, humanizing those issues really allows us to move the ball down the field.
So there's a lot of different ways I can go about this. Speaking of criminal justice, that is something I do want to talk to you more in depth here in a little bit. But one of the first things you mentioned about speaking to your audience, and you mentioned a few different issues that appeal to certain people, school choice, you know, starting businesses and things like that. Is there a particular issue that specifically resonates with the most people that you have seen, or is it kind of a shotgun of an issue here for this group whenever you're traveling, or for this locality, and then an issue here, but all speaks back to the message of liberty?
Issues have natural waves. Mm-hmm. So in the current political climate, a lot of the conversation is driven by a 5 a.m. tweet, to be quite frank. And for most Americans, for most people are not as intensely engaged in the finer points of public policy conversation. They're not constantly seeing, you know, what white paper the Mercatus Center has put out or what panel discussion is going to be at the Heritage Foundation. Most people are trying to work hard, provide for themselves and their family, save a little for retirement, and put food on the table. And so when those issues impact someone at that level, when, for instance, at the beginning of the year, when Congress passed tax reform, it was going to amount to about $88 per month to the average family they'd get back. And so as I was traveling the country, I would ask people, I said, what could you do with an additional $88 per month? The answers were various. They said, you know, people said I could pay off my car quicker, I could save for retirement, I could plan for a vacation for my family. And so that was an issue where there was a direct impact on a large percentage of the population. I think likewise today, as we're discussing, you know, as Congress is sort of wrangling whether or not, and particularly the Senate, whether or not they're going to take up the First Step Act, I think that it is injected itself into the conversation where at events across the country, when someone says, stand up if you've ever been incarcerated, and, you know, 10% of the room stands up, and then they say, now stay standing, stand up if you know somebody who's been incarcerated or if a family member has been incarcerated, and more than half the room in many of these events, people stand up, and it's because there's a direct impact on the lives of the folks who know. It, you know, particularly with the criminal justice system, it doesn't just impact, you know, the victims of the crime and the perpetrator. It's there are rings and rings of family and community members, and so it's a very widespread and high impact issue. So I think that's why we're talking about it today, and why it's in the public discourse.
Currently, I think a lot of people see the current political discourse as rather divisive, and it's just generally not healthy. And I do agree with that to an extent. But on the other hand, I also think that what we're seeing is a bit of a shift in our way that we think about our politics. And as you've mentioned, you know, the criminal justice reform is one example of that, where people from the right and the left are coming together and really agreeing with this. Do you see that is happening more often, where people are, they may be more divisive on some issues, but are actually becoming more unified on other issues that really do matter?
Many Americans, let me see how I want to put this. There are institutions in our society who sort of allow this tribalism to percolate and really encourage it. And because they win when people are divided and fighting against one another. Mm-hmm. For a lot of issues, particularly for a lot of issues that you would put under the category of small L libertarian issues, things like school choice, things like gun rights, things like, you know, lowering taxes and eliminating or reducing regulations, things like criminal justice reform, there are the reason you can build a broad coalition on some of these issues is because the tribal aspects don't matter in that realm to a certain extent, because people generally agree. And so if you can bring someone to the table and say, you know, say you have a conservative, in a rural conservative in a place like Arkansas, who is interested in criminal justice reform, he or she can sit down with an urban, a black activist in Little Rock, who comes from, well, you know, maybe a further left position, and they can say, look, we can agree on a policy goal here, and we can work on that issue. Now, maybe we don't agree on educational opportunity, or maybe they don't agree on gun rights, and so you only talk about the issues on which there is overlapping agreement, and so what you end up creating are these movements where people on a certain issue, or maybe they find out two or three issues, they can sit down and have a diplomatic conversation, and they realize that the other side isn't, they're not malicious. And so most people who are involved in public policy are acting in good faith. They have a strong set of beliefs. They want to do right by the community. We just disagree on how to do it sometimes. And so when people can sit down with one another to see that everyone is more or less working, to try to alleviate or solve the same problems, then we're just talking about, well, how do we solve it? And what are the differences? How do we empower communities rather than government? And I'm seeing that all over the country. There are other efforts too. And I want to call out two different efforts to do this. One is called Make America Dinner Again.
And yeah, I've seen that.
Mm-hmm. And one is called Better Angels, and that is taken from an Abraham Lincoln quote, "Better Angels of Our Nature," talking about the capacity for people to do good and be productive. And both of these efforts have events across the country where they bring people of diverse and divergent viewpoints together to talk about hot button issues and try to at least find not to convert someone to your view, but to understand where the other person is coming from. And I think a lot about 2 days after the election in 2016, I have the privilege and the pleasure of living in the swamp. and I knew it was when President-elect Trump was meeting with then-President Obama that Thursday after the election. And I went out to the White House because I knew there would be a protest, and I found people of different viewpoints. And before I would really dig into the conversation, I would try to find one area where we agreed on something. So at the end of the conversation, we may have disagreed on a number of things, but we found one area of commonality where if I were building a coalition of supporters for something, I could find somebody across the political spectrum.
So what is it exactly that that really got you interested and involved? What was sort of that spark for you that that made you realize that liberty was the thing that you wanted to, you know, spend your career fighting for?
I tell this story to activists, and hopefully I've told it to my parents, particularly if they hear this. But I for a time I thought I was adopted because my parents were apolitical. I was always very engaged, even in high school. I wrote for the school newspaper. As I graduated high school, I ran for local office. It was that election where my parents registered to vote for the first time, and as I always say, presumably voted for me. I asked for their vote, and one of the cool byproducts of that election, and I think my involvement, is now my parents ask questions about issues. You know, when I talk to my parents couple times about policy a month, and my dad asks some really good questions. You know, he's a high school graduate, worked in an electrical department for most of his career, all of his career, and he comes at issues from a very different perspective than I do. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of the cool things is being able to sort of talk to him about that. But the thing that really sparked it, when I was running for office in 2006, it was a guy named Clarence Yeager in my hometown who gave me a copy of Bastiat's The Law. And I sort of believed all these principles already, but I didn't have sort of a vessel to put them into. What did that look like? And I read that book, and it's like 65 pages. It's you can read it in an hour or two. And everything clicked, and it made sense. And I was I graduated from MTSU, Middle Tennessee State University, in 2009, and I was blessed and privileged to have an opportunity to work briefly at the Leadership Institute, where I worked with students in sort of the southeast and central region. But then I started training activists all over the country. And I originally went to college to be a high school history teacher. My professor said, "Get out while you still can. You'll hate the red tape and the bureaucracy." And you know, being an employee at the Leadership Institute and the headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, there were trainings in the office all the time. And I said, "Well, how do I help? You know, how can I come and learn first, but then also to teach if I want?" And they said, "Sure, let's do it." There was a big snowstorm in December of 2009, and it was a week-long training. And the activists were all in the office by Sunday evening, and by Monday morning there were 36-inch snowdrifts, and none of the trainers could come in, and I lived real close to the office, and I said, "Well, I'll come in and help," and started teaching a couple, and now for 10 years, going on 10 years, I've been working with activists across the country, originally just talking about organizing, and then now with Americans for Prosperity Foundation, organizing through a set of ideals, through a vision of a society where people are able to achieve their potential because they're constantly bettering themselves.
You mentioned that when talking about your father and how he has a certain perspective that is different than what you may arrive at some issues with. Can you tell me a time where there was a certain perspective that maybe challenged what it is that you believed, for the better, obviously, but really just dug in and really questioned a core of your philosophy, and maybe it changed it, or maybe it strengthened what you already believed?
I try to go out of my way to purposefully not only engage and interact, but also befriend people who are of different political backgrounds. So, for instance, when I'm home in where I live now in Arlington, Virginia, I try to have brunch with liberals in Arlington. I have friends who are Arlington Young Democrats, and just by the nature of this job, I'm interacting with a lot of more conservative types and some young libertarians, and I think I can't pinpoint a specific issue. It would take some time, but there have been conversations that I've had, or individuals that I've listened to, and it's been through the sharing of their personal story that I've come to understand a different aspect of an issue. I haven't spent 7 years in the criminal justice system, or I haven't spent time as someone trying to get certified to be an electrician or a barber or anything like that. And so it really, we may be, and for me, I think libertarian views are the right views. I think that empowering people to achieve their full potential by getting barriers out of the way is the best way to advance a society. But I've heard, and I've heard compelling libertarian stories to that end, but I've also heard sometimes more compelling stories from other perspectives that have given me pause. And then I think about it and I say, it's still, better to have a society where people are freely engaged with individuals and enter into contracts and organize themselves the best way they know how, rather than someone else coming in and organizing for them.
So for me, there are a number of issues that I've changed my philosophy on, especially I would say probably within the past 6 years. I'm very open about how different I am from even 6, 7 years ago. What is probably the biggest issue that you have evolved on, and have looked at and said, you know what, this is probably something that I don't actually think I believe as strongly as what I thought I did.
Really trying to get me on this one. I'm racking my brain. It's weird to say. One of the funniest memories I have from writing it in high school. So in high school, I wrote for the news section of my high school newspaper, the Blackman Voice. And in 2003, I went out on a limb, and with the teacher's permission, and I wrote an editorial in opposition to the Iraq War. And I'm from, suburban Tennessee, very conservative country, part of the country. And I remember kids threatened to beat me up because I didn't want to go to war. And I look back at that, and I think about where we are as a nation, more than 15 years into Afghanistan, and particularly with President Trump, some of his statements, or particularly early statements on foreign policy, and I think that perhaps more Americans will come along with us on that. But as your original question is, and I'm still considering all the big issues, I can't. And I really don't want to leave you or the listeners hanging on that, but perhaps I do some thinking after the podcast and we circle back around on it. But I can't think of, and I think it's because most of my philosophies is informed by Bastiat. And so if you think that the solution is individuals engaging and doing what they believe best allows them to provide for themselves, then no answer is going to be the state should do more. And so what my goal is in listening to people who do sometimes believe the state should do more, is articulate that, when they do more, when they engage in more, when they pass more laws that restrict freedom and opportunity, you have an unequal society where a certain segment is disproportionately supportive. Or disproportionately promoted by government entity and government enterprise. We see that with cronyism. And I was even thinking back to my early activism, back in Middle Tennessee, and one of the early things I did was protest taxpayer dollars to a theme park that they were going to put in. It was very popular, and ultimately they didn't approve it. So it's just there are issues throughout my activism that have really, it's funny where we've come on the issues, like how far we've come on foreign policy or on cronyism, mm-hmm. or maybe how far we haven't moved. And so just to see where everyone is on those issues. Now, on the flip side of that is I certainly don't believe that I have all the answers for the problems that we face in society. But I just know that those answers aren't another government, you know, initiative or another bit of our freedom taken away or another child in the school that isn't producing. Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I think that's one of the nice things about libertarianism in general as a philosophy is that we don't really profess to have all the answers to everyone's problems in the world. It's quite the opposite. It's that, you know, we don't, and we embrace that rather than try to pretend like there's some sort of central idea that can alleviate all of the world's woes at one time.
And that's exactly right. It is that, you know, we can't, as Hayek wrote, you know, we can't possibly know how many pigs are to be slaughtered or how many shoes are to be made. And it's people in their communities, people at the most local level. Even de Tocqueville talked about one of the coolest things about democracy in America was these associations that people put themselves into. And it's because that so many of those problems that we face in a community, be it poor, rural, and white, or you know, East LA, or you know, suburban and educated and wealthy, or you know, poor and urban and black. All of these problems are best addressed at the most local level. And so when you do it at the most local level, there are people who either through their altruistic, and they believe in maybe it's a pie in the sky vision or Pollyanna, or you know, one end of that spectrum is altruistic and the other end is self-interest, and everybody is somewhere along that spectrum and they want to solve the problem. So how do they work together? One story I do want to tell because I'm thinking about it is there's this really cool thing going on in Steubenville, Ohio. And there's an Americans for Prosperity Foundation field director out there who has put together an office, and I went out there a couple of months ago, and he had the leaders of community groups, and he had the leaders of church and civic organizations, and he had the leaders in education, and he had elected leaders there, and he said, okay, we're in Steubenville, Ohio, we want to solve the problems of Steubenville. How do we bring this collected wisdom and brain trust together to find those solutions in the community? And I mean, my heart was just beating out of my chest with how excited I was at what I saw, because it was a deep understanding of how to address the problems, and what stakeholders to bring to the table to do it. I mean, it was everybody. It was business. It was education. It was community. It was government. All there, talking about the problems of the community.
Let's discuss one issue that I did want to touch on before we hopped off, and I've mentioned this to you before. We've mentioned it a couple times on the show already. But criminal justice, and specifically the First Step Act. You have been working with GLA and AFP on you know, these issues for, you know, most recently over the past month or two, and the reaction, as far as I have seen, has been really positive. And that is something that, you know, I remember how difficult it was to get conservatives on board with the idea of criminal justice, and how much, you know, this has really changed for a lot of people on the right. Tell me about some of your experiences and some of your reactions that you have seen to criminal justice reform, and how much people have changed from your view on this.
I am just going to thread a quick needle. So in this specific instance, the First Step Act, the Grassroots Leadership Academy, in our capacity, does not advocate for the passage of a law or anything like that. However, Americans for Prosperity is engaging on that. But what I've seen, you know, there, I think there are two layers here. There is somewhat of a misconception that conservatives haven't led on the issue, and I've got a couple of examples. And then there is I think the lack of knowledge. And this isn't a I'm not saying a population is ignorant. What I want to say is there are people who just didn't realize it was an issue. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing is that conservatives maybe haven't been in this space for a while. Governor Rick Perry, when he was governor of Texas, led on criminal justice reform as far back as 2006 and 2007. And they started in Texas. They started closing prisons. And their incarcerated population was reduced. In Georgia, a conservative state, they led on criminal justice reform. As recently as just last year, I believe the former governor Nathan Deal was a national leader on criminal justice reform. And I think that there's a way to talk about it or a way to understand it historically as conservatives were for a long time. They use the phrase "tough on crime."
Right.
So if you did the crime, you hear this all the time. Do the crime, you do the time, and people didn't really consider what the time meant, or what the problems after quote the time were. For instance, something as simple as not being able to have an ID when you leave prison, and you know how do you get a job? How do you drive a car? How do you cash a check if you don't have an ID? And so there are some interesting things that allow us to be smart on crime, and the evidence that we're using, or the reason that we've developed some of these policies and ideas, is because of evidence-based research that shows that partnering with incoming people who are going through the incarceration system, going through the criminal justice system, investing a dollar on the education side, preparing them for reentry, saves you up to $5 in incarceration costs. So in Arkansas, where I'm right now, it costs $22,000 a year to house an inmate. And the average time in prison is 4 years, 11 months. So we're spending, just in Arkansas alone, $100,000 or more on incarceration for an individual. And so what is the benefit of just locking them up when 90% of them are going to get of people who are incarcerated are going to get out, and they're going to get out. So do they reoffend, or do they become productive members of society? And I want to leave the podcast on this story. There's a gentleman by the name of Matthew Charles, mm-hmm. and in the mid 90s, yep. in the mid 90s, he committed some pretty heinous crimes back to back. There's some drug trafficking, charges of kidnapping, and some other things that some pretty terrible things. And he entered, he had a mandatory minimum sentence of 35 years. And he entered the system, and for 21 years, Matthew Charles rehabilitated himself. He became religious, he found God, he got faith, he studied. He read all the books in the prison library. He was even working on helping his fellow inmates with their appeals process. And so what one of the themes that I hit on a moment ago was this notion of virtuous cycles of mutual benefit. Basically, if you improve your life, then you're able to go out and improve the community and help others improve their life. So not only did he improve his life, but he was improving the lives of those he was incarcerated with. And 21 years into that 35-year sentence, he was released by a federal judge in Nashville who did not know that it was a mandatory minimum and saw the good behavior. So Matthew Charles was let out of prison. For 2 years, he lived his life. He worked. He had a job. He had a place to live. He had a way to get around. He was volunteering his time at the local food bank. He even had, and still has, a girlfriend, Naomi Tharp. She's a wonderful woman. And U.S. attorneys earlier this year, late last year, said, you know, Mr. Charles hadn't served his time. He did the crime. He hasn't done the time. And May of this year, he was sent back to prison. And he's still in as of today. But in all of that story, he was a clear example of someone who really learned about the correction process, about the Department of Corrections, by correcting himself. You know, we didn't just babysit him for 21 years. He was improving his life and preparing for reentry, and he reentered society. Now, that's not the rule. You know, Matthew is the exception to the rule in many instances. But if that's a story of someone improving their life and going out and going from being a tax burden to a taxpayer, that's the story we have to tell. And that's the kind of behavior we have to incentivize, is people improving their lives. Because when we incentivize that good behavior, we get less of that bad behavior. And so I think that it's so critically important, as your listeners probably know, and people who discover the show, that being able to personalize and humanize those stories and encourage people to make the best decisions for themselves and for their community is the best way to organize society.
Before we go, please tell our audience where people can find you and your work, and also where people can find GLA online and on social media.
Our the Grassroots Leadership Academy is at grassrootsleadershipacademy.org. If you want to check out the website, we're on Facebook, we are on Twitter and Instagram. Those handles are GLA Training. And we use the hashtag Learn to Lead, so you can see a lot of the cool stuff that we've done. There are a ton of tweets, most recently from our level 3 training. It's an intense 3-day training that we held in Las Vegas. And then I am almost everywhere on the internet, and you can find me at Matthew Hurt, and that's MatthewHurt, and that's on Twitter.
All right. Well, Matthew, I appreciate your time that you took to out of your day to come on this program. I think our audience will get quite a bit out of it. For everyone listening, please be sure to follow me at Caleb Franz on Twitter. Be sure to follow the show at MilLiberty. Follow the MilLiberty Initiative at MilLiberty.org. Check us out on Facebook at the MilLiberty Initiative, and subscribe to us on iTunes so you'll never miss an episode or an update. And we are at MilLiberty.com online. And until next week, we'll see you.